Well, good afternoon, and thank you for being with us. Welcome to this briefing on the economic costs of nutrient removal in the Mississippi River. I'm Michael Goff, the president at the Northeast Midwest Institute, and we're just delighted to have you all with us. Today, the Northeast Midwest Institute is really pleased to release its new study on source water quality and the cost of nitrate treatment in the Mississippi River Basin. And the report presents important findings, we think, findings that are important both for the cost of removing nitrates and a report that's very important in terms of its policy implications, especially for conservation, including for the Farm Bill that's right now on Capitol Hill so prominently. This important work is possible because of the generous support of the Walton Family Foundation, and we're very grateful for their ongoing support of the Institute and all of our policy work. And we're very grateful for their commitment to the Mississippi River and to water quality. We're also grateful to the office of Senator Amy Klobuchar, who made our presence here in this beautiful room possible today. So thank you to her as well. Now I'll turn the program over to Eric Heath, who's our senior policy counsel, who will introduce our great panel, and we'll get on with presenting this, our study of Mississippi River water quality. So, Eric.
Good afternoon. All right. Today we have a great panel for you. Introducing the study will be one of our very own, my friend Sri Badashalam, which I'm probably botching his name and I apologize. He will be introducing the study because he was one of the main authors along with my other colleague Ankita. And then we have John Albert from the Water Research Foundation. He is their chief research officer and he will provide some helpful context for the study. And additionally we have Jimmy Bramblett, the Deputy Chief of Programs for the National Resource Conservation Service. He is also, which is a sub-agency within the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And finally, I will be presenting on some of the policy implications of the study and hopefully try not to mess up the work of Sri. And with that, I will kick it off to him and let him get going.
Thanks. Thanks, Eric. So, as Eric mentioned, Ankita and me worked on the scientific part, getting all the data together, and Eric added helpfully the policy piece and tying all the research that we were trying to compile with the ongoing developments both on Capitol Hill and other state programs that are applicable to this work. So the issue is, trying to just put it in context, degrading water quality, especially because of high levels of nutrients, nitrates and phosphorus, have a number of implications on water quality. We've seen examples of this in the large-scale toxic algal blooms in Toledo, but there also have been other similar, smaller issues where you have issues with water quality in terms of the reliability of the water supply, or toxic microcystin found in some of the water. I think Raccoon River in Iowa recorded some samples of microcystin as recently as 2016. So those are some of the easier problems that we are able to identify. And then there are these long-term problems that you know we talk about that relate to in investing in infrastructure, looking at you know expensive treatment options to address this problem in sort of a long-term way. So this is the beautiful picture of the Des Moines Waterworks one of the waterworks treatment plant, and this is a inside view of one of their nitrate treatment units. And Des Moines is one of our study sites, so I was able to use this photo. But this will relate to how we're talking about big pieces of infrastructure. So this is water treatment, you know, from a large scale. When you get down to it, it involves money, it involves investment, training, workforce development, consumer education, so a whole lot of it, and sort of squishing it down when I say infrastructure. So we, some of you have been to our briefings before. We've led a number of these briefings throughout the year, trying to kickstart the process and you know work with utilities. So we were able to reach out to several of them, thanks to you know all the colleagues that we've interacted with, and they helped us connect as much as possible. We were able to finally get in touch with three utilities who were interested, who were willing to share data, work with us, answer all sorts of questions, and respond to emails and phone calls. So thanks to all of them. And so these were our four study sites. Actually, there are three utilities. Two of them, one of Des Moines has two intakes, so two primary intakes. if I can use this pointer to work. Oh, it's the other way. So working from here, this is Des Moines, Iowa, Des Moines River up top, Raccoon River at the bottom, and those are their intakes. This is the Sangamon River, and this is the city of Decatur. This is North Fork Vermilion River, and this is the Vermilion County utility. This is the only private utility. The other two are public utilities. And also, point of note, the Vermilion River eventually goes into the Wabash, and then the Ohio River, and then comes back to the Mississippi over here, but the other two directly drain into the Mississippi. So, some basic information on our study sites. Des Moines, as I mentioned, has two intakes, and those are some of the bigger watersheds. Raccoon River is the largest of the two. The city of Decatur, the source is Lake Decatur, which is a dam lake located on the Sangamon River. Similarly, with the Vermilion County, its water source is the Lake Vermilion, which is a dam lake right along the North Fork Vermilion River. In terms of size, Des Moines is the larger utility. It serves more than 200,000 people. It has a high capacity, 100 million gallons, about 50 million gallons average production. So the Decatur and Vermilion County utilities are somewhat mid-sized. EPA has a certain designation of how it classifies the size. So I'm based on their classification, Des Moines is probably a very large utility, and Decatur and Vermilion would be about medium, or large, I would say. I think they're large, 10,000 to 100,000. It's in terms of number of people. Oh, I'm going the other way. Okay, so what we did was we wanted to study their watersheds. What are the contributors to the nitrate levels in the intake waters? And so we used the USGS Sparrow model to evaluate the study this watershed. And we noticed that farm fertilizer was the largest contributor in all of the watersheds. These are about ranging from about 51 to 62% or so. And then confined manure was surprisingly high in the Iowa watersheds, but not in the Illinois watersheds. And there are some other factors such as atmospheric deposition, fixation, urban sources, sewage point sources were about 1 to 2%. So really low in terms of the overall composition. So it's the farm fertilizer which is the biggest contributor in all of these watersheds. Next, we modeled some scenarios. So we looked at all the activities that are contributing to that nitrogen at the final, the output, the outlet. And we modeled some scenarios where we said, okay, what if we turned off this source? What if we decided in the next 5 years that all of the contributions from farm fertilizers will be shut off somehow magically? All of the sewage point sources, contributions would be shut off. So when we did that, we noticed that, doing that to sewage point sources essentially changes nothing. So you get from 100 to a 99. And then, with some of the other sources, you get down a little bit lower. The biggest contribution, because farm fertilizer is the biggest contributor, turning it off brings it down to 49. Of course, these are somewhat unrealistic scenarios because, you cannot turn off a source just like that. So some of the more helpful scenarios would be ones that are already policy goals. So if you look at the Mississippi River Gulf of Mexico Hypoxia Task Force, they advocate for a 20% interim reduction goal and a 45% final reduction goal. So we used those targets, and we said, okay, can we work through that? And there again, some of these sources have almost no impact, but as you go down the list, again, farm fertilizer alone, with an aggressive 45% reduction target, you would get to, reducing it by, a fourth. So you bring that reduction. But that alone is not going to be possible. That's not going to be helpful. So we cross-sector reduction. So combining some of these sources, so looking at all point sources, looking at all of the urban sources, looking at both the fertilizer and manure. So those types of combined reduction targets, that's what is going to get us. Of course, if you try to make all of them, eventually we can get to zero. But more realistic scenarios are probably somewhere here, where you do about 20% reduction scenarios with some of these combined sources. It's an uphill challenge, and so I think this sort of lays the task ahead of us when we look at what are the things that are going to be needed to get to a reduced nitrate levels at the intake sources. I hope I'm going in the right direction. So, this is one of the, I showed you for one of the watersheds, we've similar analyses for all four of them in our report. This is, oops, I think I skipped something.
Okay,
got it.
Good.
Thank you. Now, go back. Yeah, so this is the, again, Raccoon River watershed, and this is the map of the total nitrogen load to the intake point right here. And this is the total nitrogen yield, which is load divided by area. And these are divided into smaller segments called catchments. And the Sparrow model automatically makes these catchments, which are similar to smaller Huck watersheds, but I'm told that they're not exactly an overlap. And the reason we wanted to show this was, one, just to compare the two maps. So here you see a slightly different, so here are the loads, maximum loads coming in. This is divided into quintiles. So the darker the color, the higher levels, those catchments are in the top quintile. And if you look at the yield map, there is a slight difference. So that, just demonstrates that there is more of the actual load coming here, but in terms of, the yield, which is intensity of the load, there is, some difference here. The other thing is that in the north, Raccoon River has three main watersheds, north, middle, and the south for Raccoon River. The north part of the watershed has a much higher row crop cultivation practice. About 81% of the land is devoted to row crops. Whereas in the south Raccoon River watershed, it's about 60%. So you see that difference. The darker colors are up top and then the lighter colors. So that shows, where actions would need to be taken to, start getting those reduction targets that we talked about. Next, we move on to the utility scale. So where we start, working with the data that we obtained from the water utilities. So we got 10 years of daily intake concentration from all of the four intake points from the three utilities. And here is Raccoon River again. We just want to keep that consistent, but all of the details, the other maps are in our report. So here you see seasonal variation. Obviously, you'd see higher levels during the spring months, and then the winter months are, sort of the opposite. So you see those peaks here and there, but then the trend is that levels are going up, at least during this 10-year period that we studied. And the exceedances, which is what is defined as, anything above the MCL of 10 milligrams per liter, that is much higher in the second half as compared to the first half of the study period. So that we see in almost all of the locations, except in Decatur, which has a somewhat flatter trend line. But in all the other three, it's trending upward with varying levels of, going up. So it's somewhat gradual. In some cases, it's much more steep. This is a plot of the exceedances. So I talked about those days when the levels exceed those the EPA limit of 10 milligrams per liter. This is just a plot of those days annually from 2008 to 2017. This is probably, much more clearer here, because here you see at its peak, 2015 was the worst year. It's, Raccoon River, the exceedances were about 290 days or so, and here it was like almost 200 days. So more than half the year, the levels were much higher than the EPA's level. So if this was your only source, then you've got to be doing something, you've got to run your treatment unit, figure out your options. If you have multiple sources, then you might be able to do blending and rely on other sources. But if you are not in that situation, this is, pretty obviously a danger zone for any water utility. And even for the smaller ones, you see certain spikes. So in the case of Decatur, you had 2013, they had this big spike. Vermilion County had somewhat consistent levels, somewhere around the, around 40 days or so for this part of the year. So that's, that was something that we thought was informative, given what we know about the exceedances, and also these are, again, only the exceedances, but the utility doesn't operate at 10 milligrams per liter. They have lower limits. So when they receive the water, in some cases it is 9.5, in some cases it's 8.5. So this is the number of days that they would be operating their unit. And we confirmed with Vermilion and Decatur, this is their sole primary source, so they were running those units on these number of days. So for Raccoon, the average was about 80 days for this 10-year period. This is about 19 and 37. So it's less than those, Iowa, Des Moines utility, but it's still fairly significant. We also ran, just for a thought exercise, we tried to model what if the MCL limit get revised to 5 mg/L. So not an impossible scenario. It could happen at some point. Remember, the MCLs were designed in 1991, I think. So they might be due for revision at some point. And so if you look at that scenario, it's a whole different, so this is now almost, 3/4 of the year you're, trying to run this plant in Des Moines. And the biggest change is in Vermilion County, which goes from an average of 19 days to, 167 days. And again, if the MCL is 5, they're probably operating their unit at 4.5 or 4. So that's, we want to just put that in context. And taking that exercise one more step, we decided to model some reduction scenarios. So now that we know this is their exceedance, what if we start to implement those reduction targets that we talked about, those 20% interim reduction goals, the 45% final reduction goal, and a somewhat modest 10% reduction goal? What happens to the number of exceedances that these utilities are recording? And there you see those differences. If you go from this is the status quo at the beginning, and then the yellow is the 10% reduction. So you see an average of about 20 to 30% drop in the number of exceedance days, and then a bigger jump when you go from that to 20%, and then a much bigger jump if you go to 45%. So obviously 45 is your, it's a sort of a target to be achieved, sort of ideal goal. So if you could get that, then most of the utilities would, breathe. They wouldn't be thinking about, their nitrate levels in their source waters. But even a smaller reduction target would really help them, bring down those number of days. Finally, we wanted to look at costs. How does all of this information apply to the utility with respect to their treatment, how much it costs them, and how it affects consumers? So this is the three utilities that we looked at. They built their units. Des Moines started in 91. It's one of the earliest. And then Decatur and Vermilion County in the mid-2000s. We inflation-adjusted the capital cost for 2018. So that's ranging from $10 to $15 million. Des Moines, when it constructed, was about $4 million in 91. So we tried to amortize that cost and figure out how much would they be paying if we assume a 30-year shelf life at a 3% rate of interest. And that comes out to a couple $100,000 every year. And then on top of that, there are O&M costs. And these costs were variously made available to us in different forms. So we tried to compile them, make them a little bit uniform. And so that comes out to anywhere from $500,000 in the case of Des Moines to a few 60s and 20,000s. In Decatur and Vermilion County. So obviously Des Moines has been operating their unit quite a number of days, at least in the recent years. So their O&M costs are higher than their annual costs. But in the other utilities, you would see that the capital cost is the biggest expense. So once you've built it, it's even if you don't use it, it is a white elephant. You have to pay for it. And that is concerning. So if you see those spikes a few years and you're given notice violations by the EPA that you have to do something, a long-term solution, and building a plant is one of them. Once you've built it, you've got to pay for it. So that's that's one of our sort of insights from what we found out. If we convert that cost to a unit volume, so we decided to even it out and said, okay, per kilogallons, how much does it cost? In the case of Des Moines, it's a little bit cheaper. I mean, because they are a bigger utility, so they pump out 50 million gallons per day. So that's 1 cent and 3 cents. Giving a total of 4 cents. So it's a blip on the radar for their overall cost. But for some of these other utilities, now you're starting to get to, 12 cents. Again, it's not a whole lot compared to, what ranges from $4 to $7 per 1,000 gallons, most utilities. Is that correct, John?
That's a range there, too.
Okay, yeah. So based on my understanding, it's anywhere from 4 to 7, 8, depending, at least in the eastern part of the country. If you go to the west, it can go into the 10s and 15s probably. But so it's about 10% of their it's a little more. So in this case, it'd be about 5% of their overall cost. But this could be higher in years when you are running the unit for many number of days. So in the case of Des Moines, in the worst year, which was 2015, they spent about 9% of their overall operating costs just on the nitrate treatment. So those percentages can go up in specific years, bringing those costs up. And as we said, once you've built that unit, that cost is going to be high. In the case of Des Moines, as I mentioned, the exception is no longer going to be true. They are in plans for building another treatment unit, and they're going to spend $15 million on that. That $15 million amortized cost is about $700,000. So add that to the existing $700. So now you're doubling up the cost, you know, from where we are. So that's what we are talking about. We also compared, we were able to get hold of some data. We were trying to look for more utilities which had the capital costs and operating costs that we could then compare to. This is a log scale graph, so log axis on both. And most of the data we found were coming from smaller, mid-sized utilities, very little data on the larger ones. Those dark black dots are the study utilities that we looked at. These other ones we were able to find data. There's unmistakable trend. So as you go bigger in size, there is economies of scale. You get better at doing that process in terms of unit cost. But the other flip side of the argument is that once, if you are a smaller utility, you're going to spend a lot more in just building that treatment unit. So not only is that treatment unit just expensive by itself, it's also going to be on a unit basis. It's much more expensive. So if you're going to even out that cost across your user base, it's going to be much higher because we are producing a smaller batch of water. You have a smaller base of customers, so it's going to affect them more. The O&M costs were not that easy to get, so we have limited success. With the capital costs, including our three study cases, we had about 13 utilities. In this case, we had much less data. So these are two other utilities we could find in the Mississippi Basin. There is a trend, but I'm not sure I would call this anything, you know, significant. But more data would definitely help us in understanding how this goes. The issue with O&M costs is, again, it varies on input water quality and, you know, treatment technology and all other factors. So there is a lot of variation which is built in. The only other reference we found that had similar comparable costs were a study from California, Central California. They had looked at utilities only in the state of California, and I think it was done probably about seven, 8 years ago. Their rates were much higher, both for capital cost and O&M, one of which could be the fact that, I mean, California is an expensive state, and so that could be a part of it. But also it could be more robust, accurate reporting. I'm not sure exactly why. And they also had their O&M costs to be much higher than the capital cost, which was a little bit different from what we found. So there were some differences. So this is an open question for us that we want to explore further, because this is trying to understand what is the, you know, extent of impact that this would have on the consumers is helpful in making understand the impact of, you know, conservation programs, as, you know, Jimmy would talk about, and sort of seeing the full spectrum of, you know, cause and effect. So just going to summarize quickly the key findings. In our study cases, we found farm fertilizer was the largest contributor of nitrogen loading. Cross-sector reductions are needed to achieve those reduction targets. Doing, you know, something with just the one sector, just working with ag, just working with the, you know, fertilizer application is not going to be helpful alone. Over this 10-year study period, the nitrate concentrations increased, resulting in, you know, increase in the daily exceedances, which means that the unit treatment units were in operation for longer number of days. And during the second half of the study period, we had more number of these daily exceedances. And we modeled some scenarios and found that, you know, trying to undertake some reduction targets would be helpful in bringing down those. Capital expense is a significant part of the expense that the utility would undertake in terms of nitrate removal costs. And the amortized capital costs outweighed the annual O&M costs, except in the case of Des Moines, with the asterisk being that could change in the next few years. Utilities would spend more in, you know, the peak years when you have, you know, a lot of excess runoff and, you know, some worse years, heavy precipitation. And because of all this, well, from what we know, smaller utilities will face this undue burden on, you know, treatment costs. Conservation programs have the potential to limit these costs, although the specifics would vary depending on the, you know, the composition of the watershed. And we have some open questions, which is looking at a comprehensive assessment of the nitrate treatment costs at utilities, measuring the impact of conservation on water quality. Are we able to do that on a smaller watershed scale, and how we can make those connections between this program in this particular sub-basin results in this market improvement in water quality, or limits the degradation of water quality. So maybe there's so much coming in that you're no way able to figure out if it's getting better, but at least prevent it from getting it worse. And then trying to identify these data gaps in looking at, from an overall watershed perspective, what are the data that are available at the edge of the field, data for in-stream monitoring, and then at the intake of the utility, and trying to complete that picture. And our full report is available on our website as of 2 hours ago, and you should be able to read it now. Thank you so much.
All right, and now we will hand it off to John Albert. John, I'll get your slides up real quick.
All right. Well, I'm John Albert with the Water Research Foundation. I'm the Chief Research Officer, and I have a couple colleagues here in the audience to help me out here. Beata Wright, Executive Director in the Alexandria office. And is this board?
I think it's... You got to switch it around. It's tricky.
Yeah. There we go. So for just a little bit of background on who and what we are, we're the Water Research Foundation. We were established in 1969 as a research cooperative of water utilities, and the vision and mission hasn't changed since, advancing the science to improve the quality of life, and we've stuck to it. The foundation, again, we're a research cooperative of over 1,200 utilities, and we collectively fund water research across the gamut of water, historically drinking water and wastewater, but now as an integrated organization, we cover everything in between, such as stormwater and reuse. We're very excited and very proud. We have over 2,300 research projects under our belt, covering a gamut of topics, and some of those relate to nutrients and nitrate, and I'll highlight a few today. So, yep, here's my outline. I'm going to be talking about some of the... I want to take it a step above talking about research on source water protection, because that's a very active area and a very much needed area. And then talk more discreetly about two projects we completed on nitrate control technologies and where we're going to go in the future. In 2007, we had a really great convening of multiple stakeholders in regards to source water protection. It was identified that the tools provided under the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act were not sufficiently adequate for utilities to take on meaningful source water protection. So we convened this workshop, and throughout that workshop they identified three major themes: monitoring, compliance, and implementation. And those 16 projects were about $5 million in total to really execute on the new vision of source water protection. It was a great workshop that was cross-sector. Multiple regulators, USDA, EPA, were involved in that process. So out of that came this project, and developing a roadmap and vision for source water protection for U.S. drinking water utilities. What's exciting about this project, it went out and surveyed 30 utilities that had surface water sources and 30 utilities that had groundwater sources, and really looked in depth at their source water protection programs and tried to identify some common themes. And those common themes were distilled out into these four main points of developing a vision, what are the goals, and then codifying that into effective strategy and developing a framework for a utility to execute on that. And then finally, as it's executing, what's the framework to make constant decisions? So they found a common thread throughout all of those 60 case studies. But what was also common in those case studies was nutrients was front and center for the vast majority of utilities surveyed for the reason why they have a source water protection program, and nitrate being a key nutrient among them. I'm showing an example here out of the report of the Columbus Power and Water. It's the watershed they have. And they're highlighting their source water protection program is specifically focused on nitrate reduction. And you can see the vast area that they have to cover in this catchment or watershed. But it's case studies like these that really bring to light the need for supporting source water protection programs. What also came out of this project, a common theme throughout all the successful source water protection program is the need for engagement of stakeholders, finding common ground that stakeholders upstream and downstream could support in order to meet the needs of the drinking water utility. The project also highlighted the barriers that each one faced in promoting a source water protection program. First and foremost was the lack of authority. Most of these utilities don't control what's going on in their watershed, but that's the source that they have to pull the water out of. You saw it from Des Moines. They don't control upstream. I think it actually Des Moines was also in this report. The other one is restricted resources. Utilities are often stretched in multiple directions, and front and center for them, and if you haven't heard of it, is the urgent need for infrastructure, maintaining it, repairing it, transforming it, is often a priority. The third one, a belief that some other entity is responsible for source water protection. This is the understanding that utilities say, maybe it's in the purview of other commissions in the watershed to take this on. Successful programs recognize that although there might be other commissions, it's not meeting their need to reduce nutrients, so they need to play an even a more active role in source water protection, engage all stakeholders in the watershed above and beyond these commissions. And finally, the other reason was other government agencies might have control of these watersheds, either be Army Corps of Engineers or Bureau of Rec that take it out of the control of the utility. So I think it's important to understand the barriers to some of the source water protection programs, but also the key needs of these programs. So now I was asked, to dive into a little bit more about nitrate control technologies. I outline a lot here, but they've generally fallen into two major categories. Ion exchange, which is the more conventional one. Ion exchange is where you have a salt brine and it helps to pull out the nitrate. The pro is it's a very robust, very successful technology. The con is that you have to deal with the salt brine afterward. It's spent. You have to either land apply it. Depending where you are, the salt brine doesn't just pick up nitrate. It also picks up arsenic and chromium. So that waste you have is now falls under RCRA. So utilities have to think of compliance issues in that regard, so hazardous waste. But it's very, very effective. It's a proven technology. The other category is biological treatment. It's relatively new in this regard, in application. The pro is nitrate is naturally oxidized by natural microbiota. The con is that it's that the technology is a relatively new. Not so many. So there isn't a ton of case studies of it in use. That it's a little more sensitive to source water variations, but. It's a lower cost of operation, and I'm going to highlight some studies here. And then finally, we have some advanced research on, if you're going to be using the conventional technology, wouldn't it be great to be able to reuse the brine over and over than a simple single pass? And we have some new technologies that allow us to do that. So, and under them are the specific technologies that have been tested in our projects, and we can if you want to know more about them, I'm happy to discuss. So we had this project executed by the city of Glendale, who has a groundwater source, and their contaminant level for nitrate in the groundwater source was about 11.3 consistently. That's above the MCL of 10, which were shown to you previously. And they tried these three technologies here. The first two are biological. They're different versions of the biological. The last one is on conventional. So what they were doing is trying to do a head-to-head comparison of these technologies to ensure that they would meet water quality standards. So they conducted these projects, and they found that all technologies were able to meet the water quality standards that they were expecting and needed, but at different costs. So you can see the cost here for the two biological projects on construction, slightly higher than the conventional ion exchange. You can look at the annual O&M costs, slightly lower because it's a natural process. And then you can look at, this is the city of Glendale, the net present worth. These are in 2011 dollars, by the way. So you can see the costs right here. It was a very successful study, showed it worked. We were able to pull out the cost information, but the utility needed to go above and beyond, and they wanted to do a triple bottom line analysis on the treatment technology they wanted. So they not only had to look at the economic, they had to look at the societal and environmental aspects. So they took a comprehensive triple bottom line process. They looked at, you can see here, the two biological, of course, scored extremely high on environmental because, again, it's a naturally occurring process where the ion exchange, you have that salt brine you have to deal with and either land waste it or find evaporation ponds for it. Looking at societal costs, relatively similar across the board. And again, you saw the economic costs previously. What they came out with was that the biological process fit their needs, not only for the economic reasons, but for societal, environmental, because that compliance issue was extremely complex for a utility to deal with. So in another project, also dealing with a groundwater source that had nitrate contaminants of about 12 milligrams per liter, again, above the 10 MCL limit, pilot testing three technologies, one being a biological, one being a conventional ion exchange, and then a newer technology looking at ion exchange with a process to regenerate it on site. So this was a 2016 study done in Avondale, Arizona. So it did something similar. It ran through the process. There's groundwater, there isn't such major variations in water quality, so they were able to do this in a relatively short amount of time. So they were able to similarly develop costs. You get the capital costs here. You can see the capital costs for the biological and the conventional ion exchange, slightly lower. And then the ion exchange with the advanced regeneration, very much high. But then you can look across the board on O&M costs, where the conventional ion exchange is significantly higher, and then you have the 20-year present value of what that would be for these pilots. The city of Avondale also underwent an analysis looking above and beyond just the economic costs of a treatment technology, looking at everything from operational complexity to source, will the technology be able to deal with source water variability? And you can see the scores here, one being a low probability, high being a three being a high probability. And you can see that the conventional ion exchange scores are really high in this regard. That said, Again, the utility was leaning more towards a biological system because of the compliance issues related to the brine waste. I will say that ion exchange combined with a regeneration system significantly lower the cost. It's a pretty groundbreaking technology where you can use the brine multiple times so that the cost per unit is significantly reduced. And they're looking forward to seeing that technology advance, but not widely used. So in conclusion, for treatment considerations, we heard about nitrate conditions in the Mississippi watershed. If you had to break it down, biological treatment processes do show a lot of promise. There's no brine. You don't have to deal a lot with the brine. It's a natural process. That said, more research needs to be done to enhance nitrate removal, especially when source water has a variable amounts of it. Ion exchange, very robust process. At the same time, you do have to deal with the brine that's associated with it. So bottom line, what these utilities definitely highlight is cost alone shouldn't be the only driver in making these decisions for treatments. And where are we going in the future? This is a remote and aerial sensing. We've been doing some pretty groundbreaking work with the UK in this regard with UQWIR. How can satellite imagery support our decision making in this regard, nutrient and nitrate control? The ability and the hope of using satellite data for early detection or processing data over a wider field scale is showing hope to provide utilities with better decision making up front. The old saying is an ounce of prevention is worth more than a pound of cure. So this might be able to provide us some information to provide us the ounce of prevention in the first place. So that's really where we're going to be focused. You'll see a lot more work from us in this area. So with that.
Thank you. All right, we'll turn it over to Jimmy now.
All right, thank you so much, and good afternoon, everybody. I am finding myself in a very familiar position from years gone by. I have worked with what used to be the Soil Conservation Service, is now the Natural Resources Conservation Service, for about 30 years. Along the way, I had a 10-year stint as a faculty member at the University of Georgia doing water quality modeling, water quality monitoring. This was at the advent of the TMDL days in the mid-1990s. And in that day and time, water quality models were the answer. And I found myself in the field basically trying to do a lot of ground truthing in conjunction and in collaboration with EPA. And the very first project they asked me to look at, and they said, we know that this issue is 90% related to fecal coliform coming from agriculture. So I went out to the watershed that they asked me to look at, and it was an urban subdivision with a buzzard roost right above the water quality monitoring station. So I say all of that to say this. I'm probably going to make some comments that are going to make a few people in here go, what? Because the state of science from an agricultural perspective is very complex. And I have to give Alec Eccles here a tremendous amount of credit. In fact, next week we're gathering 25 or 30 research scientists basically to kind of just come in with an open mind and say, what is it that we do know? What is it that we don't know? And try to identify some of the gaps. So in this broad context of this briefing here, what I want to try to do is quickly give you some sense of who NRCS is and how we are structured, because it's a very complex organization. And as we work in the water quality modeling arena and with new partners, given some proposed language in the Farm Bill and some new programs in the most recent Farm Bill, we have tremendous opportunities here at our fingertips to actually collectively pursue a common goal here. So I heard y'all say this is complicated. It may be more complicated than I have the capability to do. So I'm going to run through some of these early slides quick, and it may seem like a daze, but I'm going to get to a very specific point toward the end. But just to give you a sense of who NRCS is, we have roughly 19,000 individuals across the country and over 2,500 field offices. This says 2,400, but we have several project offices, and it gives you a sense of the geographic distribution. Why is this important? Well, it's really important because about 70% of the land ownership in this country is private land ownership. Our task as an agency is to work with these private landowners on their property to help them address their resource issues. It's not just water quality. It can be soil erosion. It can be wildlife habitat. It can be air quality. It can be energy, et cetera, et cetera. So, but it's important to point out that what we do is science-based. We use conservation practices, and there's a specific meaning to that term that I'll mention here in just a moment. The individuals in these field offices are trained to be interdisciplinary carbon sources, I call them, 9,100 of them. We ask them to be an engineer, an archaeologist, a biologist, a geologist, an agronomist. And so we push them through a fairly rigorous planning and a training program to become certified conservation planners. And then we have a very prescriptive conservation planning process here. Not to ask you to memorize all this, but the key point about this slide is in things like TMDL from EPA, they have their 9-step process in their program. And so as they're working with utilities and others and get them conditioned from a cultural perspective to follow that, here it is, we have this whole other sector of water quality interests that follows a totally different process. And from a more of a voluntary approach rather than a regulatory approach. So some of the tools that we use that come out at the end of this process with these 9,100 individuals across the country are a suite of programs. One is conservation easements. We have 21,000 easements across the country that cover about 5.2 million acres. Many of these easements are wetland easements, and they basically have a lot of benefit for water quality like we were just talking about. And this is just a distribution of where these easements are across the country and by type. You can see that Iowa has been very active in trying to acquire easements, particularly in the wetland arena. Our most popular program is what we call EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program. It's really designed to provide financial assistance to specifically address resource concerns out there across the landscape. And we bring in almost 200 conservation practices with this program to help landowners meet their objectives and address resource concerns. Now, the key about the term conservation practice, you may have heard BMP or best management practice in the past. We take exception to that if you call one of our conservation practices a BMP. And the reason for that is each one of these practices is updated every 5 years to bring in the latest research, science, and technology to make sure we are giving our customers the most up-to-date science and the best information that we possibly can. And I should point out here at the very bottom, between EQIP and CSP, which I'll talk about in just a minute, we put on the ground over 354,000 conservation practices with individual landowners on a voluntary basis. The trick, the challenge, the magic of this is locally led conservation. It's not a situation where we here in Washington dictate what the priorities are out there to the masses. With billions of dollars for conservation investments from a taxpayer perspective, it's individual landowners every year having local work group meetings telling our local field offices, what are your priorities? And they, in turn, feed that information up to a state technical committee, which is made up of water quality expertise, agricultural expertise, wildlife expertise, and they in turn give guidance to state conservationists on how to manage these programs at the state level. And since the 2014 Farm Bill, this just gives you a list of the top 20 conservation practices that we've invested in across the country. Water quality, soil health has become a huge issue. Cover crops basically have eclipsed fencing as our most popular practice. For decades, fencing was our most popular conservation practice. But with all the focus on soil health, that in turn has become a very popular, in fact, our most popular practice. But what you'll see as you look down through this list is there is competition for water quality based off of what local work groups are saying they have an interest in trying to invest conservation taxpayer dollars in. As a complement to EQIP, EQIP's designed to address a base level resource concern. I didn't point out on that last slide, but there was an indication there's 47 resource concerns. So you might think of soil erosion, sheet and rill erosion is that erosion that moves around on the field. Gully erosion is just what it says. It's gully erosion. Soil erosion that may or may not leave the field. Stream bank erosion is soil erosion that we address. So those are just three of those 47 different types of resource concerns we work with. CSP is the Conservation Stewardship Program. EQIP's designed to address at least one of those resource concerns. The Conservation Stewardship Program is designed to get on top of or extend or improve the stewardship of that landowner to do more than one resource concern at a time. It came about in the 2008 Farm Bill, and this graph just shows the funding has pretty much leveled off in 2016 at somewhere around $1.1 billion a year. EQIP funding is basically the same. We have currently 63,000 active contracts in EQIP, about 52,000 active contracts in CSP. And this map just shows a geographic distribution of where those acreages are related to CSP. I should point out, most folks think of, and you hear a lot in when you hear Farm Bill about the Conservation Reserve Program, it's capped at 24 million acres. This program here, Conservation Stewardship Program, is the largest conservation program in the country by acres, 72 million acres in CSP. And EQIP itself has over 24 million acres. This is a list of the priorities or the high priority conservation enhancements or practices that we use for the Conservation Stewardship Program. The good thing from a water quality perspective is you see much more focus on water quality related to this particular program. And it's a lot more of the land management activities that can help abate the transport of potential pollutants from agriculture. A new program that came about as part of the 2014 Farm Bill is the Regional Conservation Partnership Program. This program brings out $200 million every year and brings in the authority of every program that NRCS has to offer. And what this program has done for us is it's brought in over 3,000 different partners, many of whom are brand new to NRCS, groups whom we never had worked with before. And one quick example I'll give you is Milwaukee and their Metropolitan Water Sewerage District. They have basically used this program and a combination of the other authorities from our other programs to help mitigate water coming into their waste treatment facility. So this program actually continues to be very, very popular. We've had the goal when it came out was to do one-to-one match of NRCS and non-NRCS funding. We haven't quite made a two-to-one match, but with the $1 billion that NRCS Plus has put into the program, our partners have put in over $3 billion in there. And then all of this gets back to the question that Sri was asking. What is the impact of all of this taxpayer conservation investment across the landscape? So I'll slow down here for just a couple of moments and make some observations and give you some experience from an agricultural perspective. CEEP is our Conservation Effects Assessment Project. We hold it pretty dear and near to our heart. We believe that it is the most scientifically defensible water quality modeling activity in the world. That's the good thing about it. The bad thing is the statistical significance of it is only at a four-digit hook. And so for the scale of projects that we're talking about, you can see we have a tremendous disconnect here. But some of the examples, and we do use it for some particular focuses, in the Mississippi River Basin, we have a 20% decrease in phosphorus. In the Great Lakes, 43%, Western Lake Erie, 36%, Chesapeake Bay, and so on and so forth. What this project does is it uses a conglomeration of other federal agencies, land-grant universities, non-governmental organizations, research institutes, to come together and collectively have that common focus of what do we think is actually happening here on the ground. One of the bases for this is something we call NRI, the National Resources Inventory. And NRI, one of the mandates that NRCS has from Congress is to report to them every 5 years what is the condition of the land in this country, what are the trends, how much farmland are we losing, et cetera, et cetera. We have over 250,000 sampling units under NRI across the country, with each having three primary points in there. And so we have over 800,000 sampling points that we use as a basis for SEEP assessments. What we're able to do with this is we're able to take aerial photography, like we were just talking about, and look at that and make some aerial photo interpretations. But then we use our field officers, who have local knowledge of what's taking place on the ground as best we can, and then we augment that with landowner surveys through the National Ag Statistics Service. And what that enables us to do, if you look at the upper left or the middle left-hand corner here where you see cropland, we can interpret that. Our local field office can give us a pretty good handle on what's going on there, but things that only the landowner can articulate back to us give us further insight as to what's taking place there. So, for example, if we see soybeans for 3 year from an aerial photograph on a piece of cropland, we might think in terms of what should be applied from a fertilizer perspective. But all of a sudden, when we get feedback from that landowner that says, you know, I started with X level of nitrogen in year one, I went down to nitrogen in year two, down to nitrogen in year three, that normally would make us scratch our heads. But based off of the landowner survey feedback, what we find out is, hey, they had a cover crop in the off-growing season, and they had a nutrient scavenging mix of species of plants out there in order to be able to recycle those nutrients out there. We have over 40,000 of these landowner surveys that we correlate with some of this aerial photo interpretation and run with our APEX modeling process. So in short, while that is something we think is the most scientifically defensible water quality modeling in the world, we do know there are a lot of unknowns. The science of ag non-point source pollution I would classify as somewhat immature by comparison to point sources. It is interesting to see that years ago when I started in water quality in TMDLs, we were all focused on the pipe and what was coming out of that pipe and how we could capture that as a contribution to the watershed and what facilities should do to make sure we maintained our overall loading for that particular water body. And the interesting thing is there's a mixed message with that also. The good news is there is a mature science behind that. Past a decade of knowing how to measure that kind of water quality. We do have some controlling factors come in. We know some expenses of what it would take in order to treat that water to be released. We have, the latest account I had was roughly 19,000 permitted point sources across the country. But by comparison, the science of ag non-point source is less mature. It's much more complicated. We have more than 7 million fields of diffuse runoff of a whole plethora of chemicals and nutrients. In the middle slide here, or picture here, basically is a picture of a research plot at some land-grant university or ARS, the Ag Research Service. And basically, we're only a decade or so away from that type of understanding of what runs off a controlled setting to something like what's on the right, which is edge-of-field monitoring. We have discovery farms from several land-grant universities. NRCS has an edge-of-field monitoring program. And so we are just now beginning to get into the real world to understand the impact, the outcome of these conservation practices from a water quality perspective, and to be able to do it in real-life scenarios where landowners have to worry about climate risk, they worry about market risk, they worry about capital risk. And so we're trying to bring all the social aspects into this as well as the physical science aspects of this. So we have our work cut out for us, and forums like this and having cross communication can only help us get to the one common perspective we want, and that's clean water for ourselves, our futures, for the natural environment, and so on and so forth. So where are we going in the future? Source water protection has come up as a huge focus in the past few days. EPA has come over to our office three times in the past month. This, you know, we talked to them on the phone. They usually don't want to be seen with us in public. But basically, they've come to us and they've said, you know, you all are actually doing a lot of good work in source water protection, and we want to better coordinate our resources and leverage resources in order to be able to do more. The proposed farm bill also has specific language in how NRCS will direct some of these conservation investments to source water protection. And then we are making other strides within the agency to move away from our planning activities being based off of models and more of our focus on science to the outcome of what the impact is associated with these conservation practices that we put on the ground. So with that, I will stop, Eric, and turn it back over to you.
All right, then, sir.
I'm going to talk briefly about the policy implications of all of the wonderful information that you hopefully just received. And I'm going to keep it short because there's not too much to my presentation, especially compared to all the research they put in. But I'll try and keep it brief. So one of the main things that I try to do here is I'm not a scientist. This is often over my head. And so I'm trying to keep it simple and to the point. And I think there's three main policy takeaways here. And the first one is immediate policy implications. And I like to consider this the do no harm sector. There are three main areas that we identified within that that policy can impact these practices. Sri identified that we have costs that are going up for treating this water because of the nitrate pollution. And we want to be able to lower that cost instead of raise it. But as we've seen with the Farm Bill, they propose doing away with a number of programs like the Conservation Stewardship Program that Jimmy mentioned. There's a lot of good, and yet they would eliminate it and fold those contracts into EQIP until they ran out. But instead of getting rid of programs like that, we should focus on funding them more. And those programs can help farmers do things like use cover crops, which will reduce the amount of nitrates that ultimately run into the water, and then we don't have to worry about removing as many nitrates to lower the costs for the utilities, better than passed on to the taxpayer. The proposed change to the Clean Water Rule by the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers has been pushed back, but as that goes forward, we can also see higher treatment costs for water resulting from that, depending on how the EPA and the Army Corps changes the rule. So it's something to look out for. Also, as the U.S. and China have battled recently over a number of trade matters, ranging from everything from steel and aluminum to intellectual property, I won't bore you with any of that, but I can say that it's led to a lot of uncertainty because China has threatened retaliation on our agricultural sector. And that's made it very hard for farmers to figure out what they're going to plant. How are you going to use certain crops like soybeans to help reduce nitrates? Soybeans are our number one agricultural export. Most of them go to China, and China has threatened a 25% tariff. That tariff was then walked back because of some negotiations between the Trump administration and Xi Jinping. But the Senate is now threatening to undo that deal by striking down part of that deal, which, again, I won't bore you with. But the point is, there's a lot of inconsistency that's coming from our trade relations with China, and that's making it hard for farmers to use these conservation practices, plan their crops in a way that we can keep nitrate runoff lower. So we want to make their jobs easier instead of harder. And that's kind of the general theme here with these three policy areas. Next, there's some more general policy implications, some takeaways that we have. Like I said, regulatory changes can increase treatment costs. We need to be mindful of that as the EPA moves forward with certain rollbacks or changes to regulation that already exist. And these costs generally hit smaller rural communities the hardest. As Sri talked about, the cost of building these facilities can get into the millions, $10, $15 million is a lot for a mid-range facility, especially when it's in a small community that doesn't have a lot of taxpayers. And that cost is then felt most hardly by those people. So we want to help these communities in ways that can help them build the facilities when they need to and help it to where they don't have to build them in the first place. But if they do, help them build it, help with the capital issues, and help them with the technical assistance so they know how to run them. Also, there are certain conservation programs, especially those that Jimmy mentioned, that can help lower these costs. We need to support those programs, we need to keep funding them, and we need to make sure that they stick around for a while. And finally, as we've identified, we need better data. We don't know everything. We don't quite know what we don't know yet either. So we need to identify gaps, we need to make sure that we can fill in the gaps that we have identified, and then move forward. So to do that, there's a number of different solutions to help utilities provide this data and keep a better track of it. come in the form of technical assistance, tying it to various things like the State Revolving Fund is something we talk about in the report, but helping us get a better feel of what these exact costs are and how we can mitigate them to, one, keep our conservation efforts going, but also lower costs for taxpayers through their utility bills. And there's also a number of legislative solutions we can utilize to fix this moving forward, and I'm going to go through those briefly. Like I said, providing capital support to small communities is a great way to help them deal with these nitrate costs. It could be through interest-free loans or debt forgiveness or some other form like that to help them deal with these costs. Secondly, like I mentioned, we could facilitate the nitrate removal cost reporting by helping the utilities with the equipment necessary, the training necessary to record these costs. And also, we can explore the possibility of taking that information and, we can look at regulating agricultural discharges as point sources. That's an issue that, if you guys have any questions on, I'll refer to Sri, because he's the expert on that, and it's a little over my head. But we're also considering looking into nutrient trading. That's one policy area that is kind of developing right now. There's a number of programs, including in the Chesapeake watershed, that the utilities are looking at ways to, it's like cap and trade, essentially, but for nutrients. And so the better information we have can help us better facilitate these programs and make sure they're actually doing what we want them to do and lower our ultimate nutrient runoff and then lower the costs associated with that. Finally, we can bolster technical assistance to help with some of these programs and some of these treatments that John was talking about. Because, like you said, there's a number of them that are very complicated. Helping smaller communities deal with that and get the training and the technical assistance they need is very important to helping us deal with these costs and the pollution. And finally, as we go through our appropriations bills, we need to be mindful of this as a cost. We need to fund conservation. We need to fund research into ways of lowering nitrate runoff and also dealing with it once it's there. Because this is a tax on the consumer. It's a tax on people who really can't afford to pay an extra utility bill or an extra, you know, $15 million for a small town. We need to spend money as a government in a way to help these people and keep our water clean. So with that, I'm going to say thank you and open it up to questions for any of the panelists. If you do have a question, I ask you to raise your hand, say your name, where you're from, and we'll go from there. And thank you all for joining us today.
Microphone.
Do
you want to keep the recording
for this?
Okay. Yep.
And just give them the
mic. Any questions? Yes.
I'm Alec Eccles, and if it was easy, it would be done. So I commend you for taking this on. My question is, why did you pick to focus on source water protection that has a lot of impediments to it? I mean, the trading opportunities in source water is minimal compared to wastewater. If you're a source water provider, you can't miss that standard at all. People's health is at risk. You know, people die when we deliver contaminated water to utility pipes. And so, you know, my real question, you know, along that line is, demonstrate for me that there's real cost savings available to communities by reducing ambient nitrate loads in waterways, given municipalities have to have that capacity for the worst case scenario.
Just speak loudly, I think.
Yeah.
We can.
If I got your question correctly, demonstrating the impact of having an EPA limit or keeping it at the current rate, is that the question?
No, the question is, the major cost of building a nitrate treatment facility is the capital cost.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have that capacity in providing drinking water to a community, not just if, you know, the exceedance happen 10% of the time. If you drop it down to 1% of the time, you still have to have that capacity.
Right.
So demonstrate to me where the cost savings can be through that vehicle? I think there are other vehicles that could be more effective cost savers than that.
Sure. I think building a treatment unit is sometimes the last option. There are several different options that are explored. Blending sources, working with another utility, purchasing water from another town, you know. So there are, so then you go through a gamut of these options, and then you end up with this, you know, decision. There was a recent coverage of this town called Pretty Prairie. I'm not getting the name right. It's Pretty Prairie in Kansas, which went through this process for a really long time. They avoided it as much as possible, tried to fake some of the tests as, you know, as often as they could to get through this reporting period and avoid getting the EPA to, you know, mandate them to build a treatment unit. Finally, they realized that they couldn't avoid it, and they have to do it now. So there are, I mean, I'm not suggesting that all communities, you know, do that, but there are often other options that could be considered before you end up building a treatment unit, especially if you're a smaller community. Many of them rely on groundwater wells, so you know, dig other sources, you know, you try to reach another aquifer. So I'm guessing that that's, you know, that's an option available to smaller communities that have access to lands and sources of water that are outside that, you know, in that same region. But once you have exhausted all those options and building a treatment unit is the only, you know, final resolve, then I guess you would have to do it. If you, I don't know the exact limit in cases of, I guess maybe John, you can help me out. But when you're, like with a wastewater treatment unit, if you're reaching 80% of the capacity, you are required to, you know, you know, start planning for the next expansion. I'm not sure exactly what is the cutoff where, you know, EPA requires you to actually start thinking about it. But certainly if you cross a threshold, you are in violation. So I'm not sure I have the exact right answer for you.
Well, they're fundamentally different drivers is what I'm getting at for a wastewater system. You know, there are days that you can exceed your permit.
Right.
Systems. When you're providing somebody with drinking water, you exceed that, you can. So you still have to have the physical capacity. That's why I'm concerned. I think it's an important critical problem. I don't think that's where there's a cost saving. There are other places where there are greater cost savings.
So if I could take a stab, we have an ongoing dialogue with a number of utilities. When I say, you know, in advancing our knowledge of source water protection, at the end of the day, historically, treatment has always been the main control of a drinking water treatment plant. We can control if we improve our treatment, and if we can't meet X, Y, and Z standard, we'll add more treatment. I think in this day and age, our conversation is expanded. What can we do outside of ourselves as a utility to promote the standards that we need? That's partner, you know, engagement and partnerships. How can we make that trade-off of building a treatment plant versus a source water protection process? And we're just starting those conversations. There's a great example that's ongoing right now in Wessex Utility in UK, where they've developed a marketplace for farmers in the region. Instead of building new treatment, they'll say, farmer, I'll pay you X amount if you reduce your nitrate. And they found this very successful, such that they don't have to build, in the last 3 years, they haven't had to build additional treatment, which they were required to under the old paradigm. And they're spending a tenth of what they used to spend. So I think approaches like that, you know, seeing what we could do above and beyond treatment that's effective and longstanding is going to be the future of this conversation.
And so it's a fascinating question. And the way you posed the question was to convince you. I don't know that I can add to any convincing. But the question does make one think, why just source water? It can't just be source water. And so in most communities that are surface water, have surface water intakes, they're receiving some out water from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you a couple of things just to think about. One is, years ago when TMDLs were a really big deal, and at the height of TMDLs in Macon, Georgia, I was heading back up to North Georgia from being in the field one day. And this was August, and they came on the radio and said, well, Macon, Georgia was fined $65,000 by the Georgia Environmental Protection Division. And the reason was their 18th sewage spill and we were in a drought, so it wasn't overflow conditions. The 18th sewage bill in that particular calendar year, and the sewage bill only had to be reported if it was 10,000 gallons of raw sewage. So, you know, the 80% threshold of having to think in terms of building, there probably are some other efficiencies to be gained internal to treatment operations. The other part of it is there are other techniques, there are other methods. New Water out of Green Bay basically was interested, and they're facing a $300 million plant upgrade. So they were interested in working to see what can we get from non-point source remediation in the watershed above. They had 27 other permitted point sources delivering water to their intake. So we crafted up and we offered them no guarantees, but we crafted up a market trading opportunity and a framework in conjunction with the state, and actually effectively transacted a couple of trades there. So it's, I think the point is bigger, not just source water, it's all of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Any other questions? All right, well, we'll conclude this here, and I want to thank you all for taking the time on this lovely Wednesday afternoon to come and hear about nitrogen removal. Like Sri mentioned, we have the study now online, and you are welcome to go view that. We'll send out an email blast about it. And we're going to hopefully be holding another briefing in about a month's time, talking about broader policy implications and other adjacent sectors. So I'll keep you all posted on that. And again, thank you for being here.